Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being here. I'd like to welcome you to our annual Helen North Memorial Lecture. I want to begin by saying just a little bit about Helen North, the lectureship, and the person. As many of you know, this annual event was instituted by the late Charles Ruff and his wife, Susan Willis Ruff, both class of 1960, and it's supported by many others, mostly Swarthmore alumni and former students of Helen North. Helen North, whose 95th birthday would have been on January 31st of this year, was Centennial Professor of Classics and taught at Swarthmore from 1948 to 1991. She was an authority in the field, a former president of the American Philological Association, the institution formerly known as the American Philological Association, among other accomplishments, and the author of several works, but especially the important book Sophrosune, on the ancient concept of self-control, published in 1966 and still cited everywhere. It's probably because of this book, this very important book, that we as a department have been so focused on teaching you not only Greek and Latin, but virtue as well. Helen worked continuously throughout her career for the good of the field of classics, of the humanities, and of higher education generally, deeply influencing generations of devoted students at Swarthmore and elsewhere, and stimulating many to enter upon careers as scholars and educators. As an educator of broad vision, she was singularly effective and persistent in strengthening several of the most important organizations that keep the classical tradition alive and that also allow us to experience this tradition at its sources. She has been instrumental in shaping the Swarthmore department and the program of classics to have the rigor and reputation that it has today, and for that we're extremely grateful to her. Helen would have been proud to welcome today's speaker, Marilyn Skinner, Professor of Classics Emerita at the University of Arizona. Professor Skinner is a pioneering and highly influential scholar in the fields of women in antiquity, ancient sexuality, feminist theory, and Republican and Augustan poetry. We're all familiar with her far-ranging work, which has done so much to establish and move forward the study of gender and sexuality in the ancient world. I'll just mention some of her books, which include Roman Sexualities, A Companion to Catullus, The New Sappho on Old Age, Claudia Metelli, The Tribune Sister, and Narrating Desire, Eros, Sex, and Gender in the Ancient Novel. The book I would like to mention in particular is her 2005 Sexuality in Greek and Roman Culture, which was named as Book of the Year in Classical Studies by Peter Green in the Times Literary Supplement. My students here are very familiar with this book because it played such an important part in the honors seminar last fall on Plato's Symposium and Early Greek Conceptions of Eros. So much more than a typical textbook. In this book, Professor Skinner manages to synthesize gracefully contemporary theory, primary texts, and cultural and historical context for every period of ancient Greek and Roman history in a way that is helpful and stimulating for students at all levels as well as for scholars in the field. No mean feat. The product of her many years of teaching, this book is a scholarly and pedagogical masterpiece that only someone with Skinner's deep knowledge and experience could have produced. It is the book that now allows the rest of us to teach courses in ancient sexuality, and by connecting the field of classics to contemporary theory, allows classicists to understand one of the most important ways that our field intersects with postmodern thought. For this reason, we're particularly excited and pleased that Professor Skinner accepted our invitation to speak today. So thank you, Marilyn, for being here today and for speaking to us about Augustus and the economics of adultery.
Okay, thank you, Professor Ledbetter, for that wonderful introduction. I feel very humble and thankful. And thank you all for coming. It's a great treat to be here. In fact, I feel quite privileged delivering these Swarthmore's annual Helen North Lecture. I regret that I met Helen North only once or twice in passing and did not have a chance to get to know her well. But the many tributes to her I have recently read give me a vivid sense of her delightful and engaging personality and her intense commitment to teaching and learning. Of course, her scholarly work is familiar to me, particularly her Goodwin Award-winning monograph, Sophrosune. When I was writing my textbook, Sexuality in Greek and Roman Culture, and needed to deal with notions of temperance and self-control in classical Athens, Zafar Sunni was the first study I turned to and the one that most influenced my discussion of sexual themes in Greek tragedy. Through her scholarship, Helen North's profound understanding of Greek ethical thought continues to shape the encounters of students, undergraduate and graduate, with the classical world. Tonight, honoring Helen North's interest in ancient ethical ideas, I would like to examine female morality, or the alleged absence of it, in Republican and Augustan Rome, together with the steps taken by the first Emperor Augustus to put a stop to women's misbehavior. This is a subject that has been heavily investigated by experts on Roman political and legal history, gender relations, and ancient sexuality, and numerous important volumes have appeared over the past 20 years. Contributions by Catherine Edwards, Rebecca Langlands, Thomas McGinn, Christina Milnor, and Beth Severy, to mention but a few. But perhaps there is room for another discussion of the topic. What I am particularly interested in is the relationship between allegations of adultery on the part of elite married women and concerns about family property in the hands of women. To borrow a phrase from Lord Byron, the issue may have been not quite adultery, but adulteration, or to be more precise, alienation. As two seasons of HBO's Rome have memorably informed us, well, let me see if that'll do it. There we go. Okay. All right. As two seasons of HBO's Rome have memorably informed us, the elite family by the final decade of the Republic was in total disarray, with adultery, incest, and murder running rampant, sons plotting their father's deaths or vice versa, and the resources of the state handed over to ruthless females, unbridled in their rivalry for pleasure and control, and there is one of them. That is not a scenario the showrunners made up of whole cloth, as it comes supposedly from the Romans themselves. In the closing lines of his short narrative epic, The Wedding of Peleus and Thetis, the poet Catullus laments the dismal moral conditions of the late 50s BCE. But after the land was drenched in sacrilegious crime, and all had banished justice from rampant hearts, brothers soaked their hands in brothers' blood. Sons ceased to mourn their deceased parents. A father wished for the death of his firstborn son so that he might freely possess his son's new bride. An ungodly mother spreading herself for her ignorant son impiously did not fear to offend the household deities. All things good and evil mixed up with wicked madness turned from us the righteous minds of the gods. For Catullus, violence and breaches of pietas within the family are the vices most characteristic of his age. Scarcely a decade later, the historian Sallust adds the final touches, presenting a picture of gender upheaval in which, encouraged by affluence and licentiousness to abandon all social constraints, the sexes have exchanged roles and compete in degradation. Quote, but the appetite for sexual offenses, gluttony, and other refinements had advanced to an equal degree. Men played the woman's role. Women made their chastity available. For dining, they sought out all the products of land and sea. They slept before they felt a desire for sleep. They did not wait upon hunger or thirst or cold or fatigue, but by soft living anticipated all these things. Depravity, according to Sallust, manifests itself through perversion, not just of those urges attached to sex, but of every natural desire, life-sustaining or not, and all forms of indulgence culminate in unrestrained orgies. Such apparent eyewitness testimony has long been a boon to filmmakers seeking to titillate movie-going audiences. And thus, in Sandel movies, the orgy is the Hollywood trope par excellence. Yet, when dealing with ancient moralizing discourses, no less than modern media presentations, we need to ask to what extent the facts, as we can determine them, have been sensationalized. And so we turn now to the historical situation. Undoubtedly, the middle years of the first century, from the outbreak of hostilities between Caesar and Pompey in 49 BCE, through the triumphal period, to the suicides of Antony and Cleopatra at Alexandria in 30 BCE, were an era of recurrent civil strife, proscriptions, confiscations, conspiracies, and assassinations, for which the poet Horace bleakly remarks, the Romans could blame only themselves. According to myth, a horrid original sin, the murder of Remus by his brother Romulus, had laid a curse on the descendants of its founder. Successive generations were succumbing to a growing madness, furor, driving citizens to turn swords against each other and causing Rome to fall through her own strength. Suis et ipsa Roma viribus ruit. That's from his Epo 16. Spread of internal conflicts was heightened, it was thought, by the brazen immorality of the aristocracy, whose disdain of religion, hunger for power, resistance to marriage and reproduction, and toleration of promiscuity had angered the gods and endangered the empire. Rome, on this line of reasoning, ruled other nations as an agent of divine justice, and if she no longer possessed the moral capacity to govern well, her sovereignty was doomed. Portents of disaster were already perceived in the 50s and 40s BCE. The freeborn population was failing to reproduce itself. Temples were falling into decay. In 53, the Parthians had annihilated a Roman army at Carrhae. From 49 on, struggles between Caesar's and Pompey's partisans disrupted the functioning of local and provincial governments. Under Caesar's dictatorship, manpower shortages continued to alarm contemporaries, and in times of uneasy peace, resettlement of veterans caused mass dislocations. While magistrates and generals were blamed for ambition and greed, and male heads of households condemned for inability to assert their authority, women's inherent weakness of character, levitas, made them especially prone to charges of sexual self-indulgence. Elite population decline was attributed to their reliance on abortion, motivated by vanity and desire to hide the consequences of illicit affairs. Female sexual offenses, especially adultery, therefore become an overriding preoccupation of our primary sources, ranging from history and oratory to legal and epistolary texts, and even to fictional genres, novels and elegiac poetry, satire and epigram. Adultery had a precise meaning in Roman law. It was defined by the status of the woman and consisted of sexual activity between a validly married female citizen and a man not her spouse. Illegitimate sex with an unmarried woman or a citizen boy was a different kind of sexual offense, stupra, or criminal fornication. The marital status of a man, furthermore, was irrelevant. Wedded or not, he could legally have sex with whomever he pleased as long as he refrained from persons who were off limits. Though an apprehended lover could be physically abused, the underlying culpability for the adulterous act belonged to the female partner who had consented to it. In the late Republic, the responsibility for overseeing and, if necessary, punishing a woman's behavior rested with her family. Cases of adultery were normally privately deliberated in a family council involving the innocent husband and the kinfolk of the offending wife, and settled through divorce and the award of a portion of the dowry to the husband, 1/6, according to the jurist Ulpian. Legal action conducted before a magistrate might result in an alternative disposition of dowry property, depending on the husband's own moral character or the claims made on behalf of children who remained in their father's custody. This process appears to have been a civilized and efficient way to ward off scandal. While in all ancient Mediterranean cultures, male honor was compromised by a woman's misconduct, public stigma in Rome was far less pronounced than in Greece. Yet the surprising fact, as Amy Richland notes, is that in a society where divorce was easy and acceptable for both parties, and men themselves had other permitted sexual outlets, female infidelity remained such a cultural obsession. This was not because adultery necessarily constituted a personal betrayal. While husbands and wives were expected to feel respect and affection for each other, elite marriages were arranged with little consideration for sentiment, and spouses may have been more emotionally invested in their children and natal kin than in their marriages. Fear of supposititious children contaminating the bloodline seems not to have been a key factor either. Under Roman law, every child born in a legal marriage was automatically considered legitimate unless the head of household refused to recognize it as his own, and there are relatively few surviving jokes about dubious paternity. To understand what adultery meant to the Romans then, we cannot consider only its concrete results. We need to discover what it represented, what free-floating anxieties crystallized around it. What features of the Roman mentality led Romans themselves to construe adultery as a practice so potentially destructive, so symptomatic of the failings of their culture, that it called for public remedies? Catherine Edwards has posed one plausible answer to that question. In a society that prided itself on virtus, meaning both its morality and its manliness, rectitude could be displayed as symbolic capital. Continence, which required the firm exercise of reason over bodily impulse, was the equivalent of nerve on the battlefield. Charges of debauchery were a tool of exclusion, keeping undesirable parties out of privileged circles by rejecting their behavioral credentials. They were also a strategy for controlling excessive spending, ensuring that nobles caused less envy through conspicuous consumption. Along with their purported lack of inhibition, women's putative craving for luxury goods put them, as we will see, at a moral disadvantage. Moreover, women were not by nature virile and could not easily be virtuous in a manly way. Their integrity was gendered differently. The chief virtue of the married woman, pudicitia or chastity, was, like a man's self-control, expected to be prominently on display. Roman sources tell us that pudicitia, although an internal disposition, was evident to an observer. The younger Seneca indeed pronounces it women's greatest adornment. Ritual processions at female cult festivals were a prime opportunity for pious matrons to call attention to their modest deportment, which brought honor to their families. Unchaste women, conversely, were thought to scorn such rites. Originally restricted to matrons of proven virtue, married only once, the altar of plebeian chastity, as Livy tells us, was later opened to women of all sorts, including those he terms pollutae, contaminated, and at last, no surprise, forgotten. As we have noted, that close association between female impurity and neglect of religion was seen in turn to lead to social upheaval and ultimately to civil war, the greatest crime against both gods and men. Rampant and uncontrolled female sexuality thus became a synecdoche for a host of other anxieties surrounding domestic and foreign instability and fear of divine displeasure. But The root cause of all those ills, Sallust emphasizes, was the increasing wealth that flowed into Rome as her empire expanded. Money and the luxury that accompanied it had a softening effect on character. Here again, women were to blame because their public appearances, whether on religious occasions or for other reasons, demanded more and more ostentatious trappings. Gold, jewels, expensive dresses, carriages, slaves as escorts. Dowries too rose in amount as leading families competed to place their girls in advantageous marriages. During the course of the Punic Wars, mothers, sisters, and wives inherited money from fallen family members, and rich fathers without surviving male heirs bestowed whole estates upon daughters. What would like-minded women do with all those resources? From the 2nd century BCE onward, wealth in female hands became a nagging problem for elite male heads of households. Culturally, the Romans engaged in a certain amount of doublethink regarding women's ability to own and manage property. On the one hand, the Law of the Twelve Tables, Rome's oldest legal code, stipulated that in the absence of a valid will, the patrimony would be divided equally among the children who were its immediate heirs. Though a woman's capacity for ownership was therefore recognized in law, her management decisions regarding real property, such as disposal of land or buildings, were subject to the approval of a male guardian, a tutor, charged with ensuring that assets destined for blood relatives were not prematurely alienated through sale, gift, or bequest. In practical terms, this meant that women could not endow daughters or make wills without the permission of their tutor. In one form of marriage, sine manu, or free marriage, tutelage severely limited their testamentary freedom to provide even for their own children. With the increased economic importance of women's holdings came a change in the legal position of the wife within a marriage. Roman family law was grounded upon patria potestas, the life and death authority of the pater familias, the oldest representative of the paternal line, over all the members of his household, including his children. From the beginning, however, the law allowed for two kinds of marriage, cum manu and sine manu. In a cum manu marriage, control over the wife, or manus, was transferred from her father to her new husband. Her dowry passed into the bridegroom's ownership, and he was responsible for paying her personal expenses out of its proceeds. The bride became a member of her husband's family and, for inheritance purposes, was legally treated the same as one of her own children. If the husband died intestate without a will, she received a share equal to each of theirs. Upon his death, she became legally independent, sui juris, though still required to have a tutor. However, the husband could name a sympathetic tutor in his will or even allow her to choose her own tutor. Less anxiety surrounded the woman's possession and management of property because it was assumed she would use it for the benefit of her children who, like her, belonged to their father's family and were her natural heirs. Larger and larger dowries, however, created an issue for the bride's clan. Under cum manu marriage, a sizable amount of the patrimony became the irrevocable property of another household, depriving the bride's siblings of their eventual claim on it. As a result, the second kind of marriage, marriage sine manu, gradually became more popular. Under this arrangement, the father of the bride retained manus, and she remained a member of her natal family. While the groom had the use of dowry income, the principal had to be returned to her family if the marriage ended in death or divorce, although a share was retained for the children. In a patriarchal culture, the subversive legal and social ramifications of free marriage were considerable. Husbands could not punish their wives for wrongdoing. The father alone possessed that right. Since the wife lived with her husband in another house, it was comparatively easy to escape paternal supervision. When a father died, his power over his daughter terminated, and she became legally independent with full ownership of her own property. Under law, the holdings of a wife and husband in a sine manu situation were separate. He had no say over what she did with her money. To prevent one party enriching the other at their own expense, gifts between husband and wife were forbidden. All this obviously worked to the wife's personal advantage. On the other hand, a woman's children were regarded as belonging for custody purposes solely to their father, who exercised patria potestas over them. A paterfamilias could thus arrange a marriage or disinherit a child without the mother's consent. And if the mother died intestate, possibly because her tutor refused to approve her will, her property passed to her siblings, not to her husband or children, who were members of a different family. Sine manu marriage ensured that ancestral land and buildings remained with the clan at the cost of the marital bond, which was slackened because husband and wife no longer had financial interests in common. Yet, despite its adverse effects on spousal relationships and the greater autonomy it allowed women, which was seen as especially problematic, sine manu unions were the norm by the end of the Republic. Divorce, easily available to either partner under those conditions, was likewise common as marriage alliances created to forge strategic ties fell victim to shifting political currents. To conclude, the concern about the destabilizing impact of legal changes on individual families took the form of free-floating anxiety over women's adultery is speculative, of course, but it seems highly probable. The less commitment a wife felt to her husband's household, the more likely she was to form attachments elsewhere. Already in the 2nd century BCE, the state may have reacted to those social trends. The Lex Voconia, passed by the Senate in 169 BCE, stipulated that testators of the highest property classes could not name a woman, not even an only daughter, heir to an estate. It also restricted no more than half the value of an estate the amount of wealth that could be left as a legacy to anyone, male or female. Taken together, the two provisions guaranteed that a woman would receive at most 50% of the inheritance bestowed by will upon a male citizen. Women's right to intestate succession was not affected, but since Romans preferred to make wills, female capacity as both legatees and testators was reduced. Formerly, a husband might institute his wife as sole heir to manage the property for his children's benefit. That was now prohibited in view of the limitations on how much a legatee could receive. Preferring a daughter's interest to those of a son was also discouraged. Wealthy women, already subject to tutorial oversight in the matter of wills, would be even less likely to pass valued possessions along to daughters. Since, in the absence of a valid will, the estate of a woman married sine manu reverted to her blood relatives, the primacy of natal family succession was reaffirmed. We have no ancient testimony about the intentions of the legislators who passed the Lex Voconia. There is thus considerable scholarly debate over what it was meant to achieve. While one widespread claim is that it directly aimed at controlling female access to wealth, experts on Roman law and economic history propose other explanations. Perhaps it sought to prevent a daughter from taking more than her fair share of the estate by receiving part of it as dowry on her marriage, a form of premortuary inheritance, and another part after her parents' death. In an increasingly competitive political arena, it may also have freed up more assets, enabling men to seek office. Wealth in the hands of women, Jane Gardner remarks, was out of circulation for such purposes and would remain so if women made other women their heirs. In any case, the Romans themselves perceived the law as working for the benefit of men, but full of injustice to women, as Cicero's speaker complains in Res Publica, Book 3. It was also thought unfair because some women, for example, Vestal virgins, were exempt from it, and because it was ineffective. Numerous legal dodges were employed to get around its restrictions. I list a few on the slide. Lastly, it utterly clashed with popular sentiment regarding property transference. In spite of parental or spousal wishes in individual cases, though, the law bolstered a certain general underlying premise. Property in the hands of women was not absolutely theirs. It belonged to families and should ultimately go to promising male heirs to support them in the pursuit of political and military honors. However, much of women's new wealth was in the form of liquid assets, which, unlike real estate, were not subject to tutorial control and were viewed as highly vulnerable to misuse. Thus, wives who spent to please themselves, particularly on luxuries, were valuing their own pleasures above the ambitions of their male kin. By definition, they were out of control, and so was the money they squandered. Such was the legal position of affluent women when, in the wake of his successful victories over Antony and Cleopatra and his two administrative settlements of the state in 27 and 24 BC, the Princeps Augustus embarked on a campaign of religious and moral reform. In the 30s, as triumvir, he had already initiated an ambitious program of temple restoration, including rebuilding the shrines of patrician and plebeian chastity, a task delegated to his wife Livia, and followed it by constructing and dedicating a number of sacred and public spaces. Now, in 18 BCE, Augustus confronted head-on the issue of population decline among upper-class families and the accompanying problem of adultery. That year, as part of an extensive package of social legislation, he enacted two famous laws, the Lex Iulia de Maritandis Ordinibus, which was later modified by the Lex Poppaea Poppaea of 9 CE, and its companion piece, the Lex Iulia De Adulteriis Coercendis. The first strengthened class boundaries by prohibiting marriages between members of the senatorial class and former slaves, and between all freeborn citizens and infames, morally disgraced persons like pimps, actresses, and criminals, including those convicted of adultery. It also encouraged procreation by offering rewards to parents of several children, career advantages for men, and freedom from tutelage for women, while single, childless individuals were penalized by being prohibited from accepting bequests from anyone other than close relatives. Since leaving substantial legacies to friends and allies, possibly with long-term political and familial objectives in mind, was an established custom in senatorial circles, that sanction was not a trivial one. Meanwhile, the second law repressed adultery and stuprum by making them civil offenses to be tried in a standing criminal court. Procedures for prosecution were spelled out in detail. A husband who became aware of his wife's adultery had to divorce her immediately, since under law, a woman still married could not be accused. Either he or her father, as paterfamilias, was then obligated to bring a charge against her within 60 days. If he failed to divorce her, he himself could be prosecuted for lenocinium, conventionally labeled pandering, but more accurately defined as being an accessory to her crime. Should neither husband nor father exercise his responsibility to prosecute, a third party might do so in the hope of receiving a portion of the confiscated goods if she was convicted. The law prescribed that the two parties involved could not be tried simultaneously, and one had to be convicted before the other could be indicted. Provisions allowed a father, or with certain restrictions, a husband's, to kill transgressors caught in the act in the father's or husband's house. Those points of law were much discussed by ancient jurists who wrote treatises on them, and they still arouse considerable scholarly debate. In the interest of time, I will not go into the parts of the statute that dealt with persons apprehended in adultery, as my focus is on the criminal penalties, chiefly financial, imposed after trial upon someone convicted in criminal court. The punishments ordained were not merely deterrent, but arguably had as a further goal the reclamation of patrimonial assets from those proven unworthy to possess them. Legal provisions suggest that condemned women may have been the primary intended targets. Our information about fiscal penalties comes from a late but presumably reliable source, the 3rd century CE opinions, Sententiae, falsely ascribed to a famous Severan period lawyer, Julius Paulus, quote, "It has been held, women convicted of adultery shall be punished with the loss of half of their dowry and the third of their estates, and by relegation to an island. The adulterer, however, shall be deprived of half his property, and shall also be punished by relegation to an island, provided the parties are exiled to different islands." Roman law had to spell it out. We do not know whether deportation to an island was permanent or temporary. Perhaps that was left to the discretion of the court. In any case, although both parties to the crime are punished, the financial harm wrought upon the adulteress, as stipulated by the law, was considerably greater. The amount of dowry confiscated went far beyond the 1/6 granted to the injured husband before the law was put in place. In addition, she lost a sizable portion of her private property. What dowry remained was useless for practical purposes, because from other sources we learn that she was forbidden to remarry. If she did, her new husband was liable to a charge of lenocinium, and if adulterous lovers, having escaped from their separate islands, married each other, the union was null and void, exposing them to the prohibitions on inheritance visited upon unmarried persons. The convicted woman was also punished by a loss of rank. Stripped of the symbolic dress of a matron and branded with infamia, lack of respectability, she was obliged to wear the toga, the professional garb of a prostitute. The social effect of this last regulation was to draw a strictly defined line between two classes of women, the respectable mater familias and the non-respectable prostitute, who, as a woman with no virtue to lose, was exempt from the adultery law, and permanently to isolate the adulteress by conflating her with the latter group. Public shaming reinforced the class degradation imposed by depriving her of property. Now, what happened to her confiscated wealth? In the late Republic, the assets of persons condemned for crimes against the state were seized and sold at auction. We have no precise evidence for the disposition of adulterers' estates under Augustus, but the emperor seems to have taken charge of auction profits and employed them at his own discretion. For example, by offering limited term interest-free loans to borrowers with solid collateral from surplus funds realized through sales of impounded property. We learned that from Suetonius' Life of Augustus, chapter 41. That policy benefited the senatorial class, whose holdings, while large, were not readily converted into cash if needed. Tacitus, meanwhile, indicates that the belongings of those who died intestate without kin were also petita in fiscum, claimed for the fiscus, that is, for the emperor's private account, as opposed to the aerarium, the public treasury. The same historian later paints a sinister picture of an oppressive government policing the private lives of citizens, forcing compliance with its objectives through a system of informants and enriching itself by confiscations. Finally, in his sixth consulate, Caesar Augustus, secure in his power, abolished what he had ordered during his triumvirate and laid down laws by which we might avail ourselves of peace and of princeps. From that time on, our bonds were tighter. Spies were introduced and induced by rewards under the Lex Papea Poppaea, so that if men balked at assuming the privileges of parents, the state, as parent of all, might lay claim to their vacant estates. On the strength of this testimony, some might suppose that, in addition to the laudable aims of promoting family life and increasing manpower, Augustus' motives for introducing his legislation included the less laudable goal of lining his own pockets. Andrew Wallace Hadrill, however, not only dismisses Tacitus' snide hints at extortion, but also regards military recruitment as merely an ideological justification for the marriage law. Its practical intent, he argues, was to stabilize the transfer of patrimonies within elite families from one generation to the next, and thus to ensure continuity of rank and status. Through restrictions upon inheritance, bequests outside a direct or, failing that, a lateral line of descent were made problematic. Legacy hunting by the childless was discouraged, and established families assured of the adequate resources. We see these goals operating on the occasion mentioned earlier when Augustus' successor Tiberius, this is the passage, the first passage on this slide, instead of appropriating the vacant estates of citizens dying without wills or immediate heirs, passes them on to remoter kin. This is termed an act of generosity, liberalitas, implying that the emperor had no obligation to do so. Tiberius' explanation of his reasons is instructive. The good birth of each man, he says, ought to be bolstered by wealth. Augustus would agree. After he raised the property qualification for the senatorial order, he personally made up deficiencies for current members of the Senate whose holdings were insufficient. If we assume that the adultery law had corollary objectives, we may hazard a guess that some part of the property taken from offenders was restored to family members, avoiding the unintended consequences that could befall blameless children or relatives. We remember, for example, that under the old system, there was a practice termed retentio propter mores, whereby the cuckolded husband was awarded reparations from the dowry for the wrongs he had suffered. Similar compensation, deducted from the share taken by the privy purse, could induce men to comply with the law by divorcing and prosecuting a suspected wife. This concession would lessen the amount of dowry husbands were obligated to repay, a legal expectation that imposed financial hardship upon the victimized party. Similarly, the natural heirs of a condemned individual whose own capacity to preserve rank and status was put at risk by government seizure of assets, would be logical persons to assist if they themselves were parents of at least one child. While the jurists do not tell us explicitly that repayments took place, it is certainly possible then that the law facilitated the transfer of family property, which had fallen into putatively irresponsible hands, into the possession of recipients more deserving. For reasons I have already touched on, it is likely that the irresponsible hands were largely female, and the deserving ones male. Whether or not that succession suggestion seems plausible, the ultimate question is whether Augusta's moral legislation had a successful outcome. In the absence of demographic data or judicial records, that is a much debated issue. Historical sources tell us the marriage law was widely resented, and Tacitus flatly says that it did not work, though his bias is obvious. At the opening of his histories, which record events following the deposition of Nero, the same historian speaks further of adulteries in high places and islands filled with exiles. But again, in the context of a rhetorically embellished account of Rome's troubles, it does seem that the adultery law, for its part, proved difficult to enforce. However, women who behaved indiscreetly in public, whether or not they were really involved in an affair, no doubt endangered themselves, all the more so if their riches made them tempting targets. Indeed, Tregiari surmises that a woman who divorced a husband unilaterally for any reason might regret it. If she remained single, she would be subject to the inheritance restrictions imposed on the unmarried. And if she remarried, she laid herself open to charges of prior adultery. Thus, the law encouraged women to remain in less than ideal marriages so as to avoid potential prosecution. Husbands, too, needed to monitor their wives' behavior to ensure they stayed above suspicion. Otherwise, the man could be accused by a third party of knowing collusion in adultery. Far from bringing stability to married life, Tregiari concludes, Augusta's legislation made relations between spouses more insecure. On the other hand, if the younger Pliny's famous portrait of Ammidia Quadratilla is anything to go by, some women under the empire seem to have incurred public disapproval for indulging their caprices while avoiding reprisals. In Epistle Book 7, 24, Book 7, Pliny is attesting to the merits of his protege. Her grandson, Ummidius, a virtuous young man, despite having been raised by his grandmother, whose fondness for her troop of freedmen, pantomime actors, had made her notorious. With a delicate appreciation, reverentia, of the need to keep his reputation unblemished, says Pliny, she sent Ummidius away to study whenever she watched them perform. While Pliny represents her interest in pantomime as merely a regrettable extravagance unworthy of her station, foe vacque fusius quam principi feminae convenit, it has been viewed as a shrewd business venture because sponsoring entertainers could bring a substantial return on investment. Be that as it may, the loose associations of pantomime, both the risque nature of the genre and the close link in the public mind between all actors and prostitution, might blemish a widowed matron's character irrevocably. Yet, Ummidia lived to be almost 80, sound in mind and body, with apparent indifference to her own good name, however careful she might have been about those of her descendants. In the end, all seems to be forgiven, since Pliny explains that she made an exemplary will, leaving 2/3 of her estate to her grandson and the remaining 1/3 to her granddaughter, with only a small gratuity, corollarium, to her pantomimes. Consequently, he delights in the pietas of the dead woman, the honor paid to an excellent young man. Property, in short, is back where it belongs, unalienated and unadulterated, ready to advance another distinguished masculine career. For that, Pliny, like every right-thinking Roman male, is grateful. And if Augustus had anything to do with it, so much the better. Thank you.